Hare Ram Ram Ram. Everybody, welcome back to Mishnah. We are going to plow into the last chapter of Sota today, which I'm hoping we will actually finish by the end of the week. I just wanted to say briefly, as a one note on the chapter we were working on, and yesterday we encountered the three different kinds of wars: the elective war, Milchamet Reshut, the war that is a mitzvah, and the war that is chovah, obligatory. There's really quite a lot of different positions about how you define each of those categories. From a textual level, there's some consensus that conquering the land and the initial seven nations and the battles described in the book of Joshua and laid out in the book of Deuteronomy, right, in anticipation of entering the land, are milchemet mitzvah. They're certainly enumerated as commandments to fight those wars. In contrast to later expansions of territory that King David pursues, which are characterized as more elective. But then there's some debate actually about wars that are to prevent attack from other nations. And the one thing I'll say, when we have the question of how is this all relevant today, there's a major debate between Maimonides and Nachmanides around whether wars to conquer the land continue to be in the category of mitzvah, or if that was really narrowly constricted to that initial time period of entering the land in the days of Joshua and those seven nations, and that actually since all of the dislocation and the rabbinic perspective is we can no longer identify who those seven nations are. There's no longer such a thing as a war that is a mitzvah. That is Maimonides' position. That will not exist until, in his view, the days of the Messiah. And Nachmanides, on the other hand, thinks that wars to gain sovereignty over the land continue to be a mitzvah. So that is a major debate that animates quite a lot of Zionist debates in the modern period. Okay, we're gonna move on to something I wouldn't say it's less political in the current moment that we're in, which is the next chapter deals extensively with the Egla Arufa, the ritual to deal with an unsolved murder. So that's what we're gonna look at today.
Did David conquer lands that were outside the land that...
The initial territory. Right. So this, it's kind of complicated. The question is, which wars are we talking about that he pursued, and how do you understand the initial borders? Was he conquering in order to loot? So that's a larger question. But you can look a little more at the commentaries on this Mishnah. This Mishnah is, and the Talmud on this Mishnah is one of the major sites for delineating these different kinds of wars. Okay, gonna shift into screen share mode here. Chapter 9. Okay, share you again. Here we go. Okay, so this is based on the passage in Deuteronomy chapter 21. If you find a corpse that, right, somebody slain, found lying in the open, the identity of the slayer not being known, your elders and magistrates shall go out and measure the distance from the corpse to the nearby towns. The elders of the town nearest to the corpse shall then take a heifer, which has never been worked, which has never been pulled in a yoke, and the elders of that town shall bring the heifer down to an ever-flowing wadi, which is not tilled or sown. So think of the sort of rocky surfaces. There in the wadi, they shall break the heifer's neck. The priests, sons of Levi, shall come forward, for the larger God has chosen them to minister to him and to pronounce a blessing in the name of the Lord, and every lawsuit and case of assault is subject to their ruling. Then all of the elders of the town nearest to the corpse shall wash their hands over the heifer whose neck was broken in the wadi, and they shall make this declaration. You can see I bolded this in the Hebrew. Ve'anu ve'amru. They shall make this declaration. So we said that's a refrain in Deuteronomy that our chapter in Mishnah is picking up on, as things that are recited in Hebrew. They say this in Hebrew. Yadeinu lo shafchu et adam hazeh ve'einenu lo ra'u. Our hands did not shed this blood, nor did our eyes see it done. Absolve, O Lord, your people Israel, whom you redeemed. Do not let guilt for the blood of the innocent remain among your people Israel, and they will be absolved of blood guilt. Thus, you will remove from your midst guilt for the blood of the innocent, for you will be doing what is right in the sight of the Lord. That is the biblical passage. So you can see there's a number of different groups and leaders who are involved here. The elders that are cited in the beginning, the elders of the town, and the priests. And we'll see now how this ritual unfolds in the Mishnah. And I will add that this is something where, again, is this just in Tractate Sota, because it's another thing that's recited in Hebrew, and we've gotten into that question about which things are in Hebrew, which things are not in Hebrew, this is a little bit more parallel to the ritual of Sota, in that we have a ritual responding to a situation of some level of doubt. It's not known who killed this person, so it's impossible to do sort of a full trial and what the judicial process would usually be in the case of a murder. There's doubt and a ritual in the face of doubt. And so too in Sota, there was a ritual in the case of doubt. But we'll see some more technical overlaps as we go on. Okay, Mishnah Aleph. Egla arufa bilashon hakodesh shene'amar ki matzei chalal ba'adama vigomer. We just did that vigomer. We looked at that full passage. V'yatzu zekeinecha v'shoftecha. So the declaration for the heifer whose neck is to be broken must be recited in the holy language, as we saw in the verse, and it had that phrase, "Va'anu va'amru," they shall declare. Then your elders and judges shall go out. Who does that refer to? The Mishnah clarifies. It's three from the great Beit Din that was in Yerushalayim. So these are three coming from the Supreme Court, as it were, to do the initial stage of this ritual. There's a debate about this. Rabbi Yehuda Omer Chamisha. Rabbi Yehuda says it's five, not three judges. Shene Amar Zekeinecha Shnaim, Vishoftecha Shnaim. So there's two different words for leaders, elders and judges. Those are both in the plural. So elders, plural, there must be two elders. Judges, plural, there must be two judges. That would make four. Ve'en Beit Din Shakul. You can never have an even number of judges on the Beit Din. Mosifin Alehen Od Echad. So we just have to add another person. Five rather than three. Okay, that's step one. Right, dealing with sort of the first stage of leadership that has to address the murder, and that is the most central and supreme court. Okay, we're going to go on. I want to kind of lay all this out, and then I'll turn to your questions. Mishnah 2. Nimtza tamun begal, o taloi ba'ilan, o tzaf al pnei hamayim, lo hayu orfin. If they found a corpse that was buried under a heap of rubble, buildings collapsed quite a lot then. We have a lot of Mishnayot that deal with collapsed buildings that were made out of stones. And so if they're found under a collapsed building or hanging on a tree or floating on the surface of the water, then they did not go through this ritual and break the heifer's neck. Why? We're going to get a totally technical answer that may not be satisfying. Shene Amar, as it says in the Pasuk, Ba'adama has to be on the earth below Tamun Baga, not buried in a heap of stones. Nofel has to have fallen on the earth, below taloi ba'ilan, not hanging in a tree, basadeh in a field, below tzaf al pnei hamayim, not floating on the water. And one commentary points out that really from the word ba'adama, on the earth, you could have derived all of these, right, on the earth, not in a tree, on the earth, not on the surface of the water, but this Mishnah instead pins each of these exceptions to a word in the pasuk. Okay, we can talk about what it means to limit this in this way, right? It seems like it could be disturbing to find someone hanging on a tree just as much as it would be to find a corpse lying on the ground. I think maybe in the case of the collapsed building, can understand better that we could understand that this was an accident. Maybe also in the case of floating in the water, maybe it would look more like an accident. And I think maybe the most confusing one on this list is the case of hanging in a tree, which seems like it would have more intent around it. Right, I may be overloading by using the language of murder to translate this, but that's because that's what we are leading up to here, the assumption that this might have been actually a deliberate death. Yeah, suicide. I was wondering if hanging in the tree the assumption might be that is suicide, but the text doesn't get into that more extensively. Okay, the debate over the number of judges doesn't necessarily mean that the rabbis had no experience with the ritual. There's a lot of debates about a lot of things that were live and did happen. Okay, we're gonna do the next clause here. Nimtza samuch la'sefar, o la'ir sherubah nochrim, o la'ir she'ein ba beit din lo hayu orfin. So if this person is found next to Sfar, is a border city, meaning it borders it's on the borders of Israel, so it's right next to foreign territory, or if it was found next to a city that was majority Gentile, which could have been quite common in the times of the Mishnah, or a city that doesn't have a court, so there's maybe a lack of law and order, to use a phrase that I might not be the wisest to use in this moment, then they would not break the heifer's neck. And this is where the commentaries talk about this person maybe ventured at their own risk, in the assumptions of this text and the relations between Jews and Gentiles, however much that's based in reality, the assumption is that a person was putting their life at risk to a greater extent if they were close to Gentiles or close to a city where there's no strong leadership. Okay. Ein mudadin ela me'ir sheyesh ba beitin. You only measure from a city that actually has a beitin, not from a city in which there is no beitin. Nimtza mechuvan bein shtei arayot. Let's say it was found exactly between two cities. They're equidistant. Shtehen mivyot shtei agalot. Then they both would bring two heifers. Divrei Rabbi Eliezer. That's what Rabbi Eliezer says, right? That position seems to assume that the point of this ritual is more about leadership taking responsibility and less about some sort of blood ritual to atone for this one body that died, right? It wouldn't make sense to have two acts of atonement for just one body that died, right? This points towards the ritual really being for the Beit Din taking responsibility. It's interesting, and in some ways, it's hard to imagine two cities being totally equidistant. I suppose it depends a little bit on the exactitude of, you know, measuring that existed at the time. But in many ways, I would say this debate mostly points towards that substantive point rather than the technical point that Rabbi Eliezer thinks this is about Beit Din taking responsibility primarily. And finally, we have a clause, Ve'en Yerushalayim Mivi'a Egla Arufa. Jerusalem never brings an Egla Arufa. So even if there is a corpse found near Jerusalem, we don't go through this process for Jerusalem. Okay, I'm gonna do one more. I just wanna make sure we see the full picture here, and then we'll jump back to comments. Mishnah Gimel. Nimtza Rosho, it gets a little graphic. Nimtza Rosho b'makom echad, v'gufo b'makom acher. Let's say the head of the body is found in one place and the body in another place. Molichin harosh etzel haguf. You bring the body to We bring the head to the body. Divrei Rabbi Eliezer, and commentary explains here that that is the assumption Rabbi Eliezer has, is that the head may have rolled away from where the act of murder happened. Rabbi Akiva Omer Haguf Etzel Harosh, the body comes to the head, and he assumes that the rest of the body may have dislocated from where the head was. Also possible that there's some debate here around what's sort of considered to be the more primary part of the body. Don't have a lot more to say on that Mishnah. It is graphic and I think maybe uncomfortably makes us envision the details of a murder, which, as uncomfortable as it might be, is maybe also important in terms of being attentive to what has happened here. Last one, and then I'll look back at the questions. Me'ayin hayu mudadin? Where did they measure from? Which part of the body did they measure from? And just to be clear, the fact that the Mishnah is asking this implies that the previous Mishnah about whether you bring the body to the head or the head to the body is not actually about the question of where you measure from entirely. It might also be a question of where do you bury the body. So for a mitzvah, a corpse that one finds lying around, right, there's a mitzvah to bury the body besides this whole elaborate ritual in the case of an unsolved murder. There's a mitzvah to bury a body. And so Mishnah Gimel might have been focused on that question of where do you bury the body. Where do you measure? Which part of the body do you measure from? Again, sort of, we have to think about what the point is of this Mishnah. Is there really a case where the difference between location of the city is going to be whether you measured from, you know, the nose or the navel? That seems unlikely. So the point of this Mishnah might be to teach us something else, which we can talk about in a second. Where do you measure from? Rabbi Eliezer Omer me tiburo, from the navel. Rabbi Akiva Omer me chotmo, from his nose, right where you breathe. Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov Omer mimakom shenaaseh halal mitzavaro. Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov says from the place that this person was made into a corpse where they were slain, namely the neck. So tiburo would bring us to the middle of the body, also what gave this body life in the first place, right where the umbilical cord was. Chotmo, the site of breathing, that shows that this person was alive when they were alive, as opposed to Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov drawing us to the most important piece here being the act of murder, the neck. Okay, those are our initial details around this. Just going to pause here for the chat. So, right, what is the function of this ritual? Does it remove all communal possibility or just the need for ritual public tshuva? I think we'll actually see a Mishnah that responds to that later in terms of, is this all that the leadership needs to do, or do they need to do more? I would say specifically, maybe do they need to do more around making sure this type of thing doesn't happen again? Do they need to do more to try to continue to track down the murder and what happened in this case? Those are two questions that I think a little bit later in our Mishnah we'll see responses to that. I cannot explain the meaning of sacrificing an animal for this in a major term. So I think it's definitely deductible to biblical scholarship on this. And specifically the idea that whenever there's a loss of blood through murder, there has to be some kind of atonement through blood. And even in the case of accidental murder, where somebody can escape to a city of refuge and stay there until the high priest dies, that we see spelled out at the end of the book of Bamidbar, but the idea there seems to be part of what's happening is that the blood of the high priest when he dies is atoning for the blood of the accidental murder. So definitely the way that blood and atonement work in the Torah, there's an idea of blood that needs to atone for a case of murder. Okay. I'm going to get back to our Mishnah. We don't see any more in the Mishnah about what tools they use to measure. And it seems from other rabbinic sources that, yes, the main way that Roman capital punishment was administered was through decapitation, which might be why Rabbi Eliezer talks about the tzavar, the neck, as the place he was made into being a corpse. But I don't know, don't want to overread. Okay, Mishnah Hay. So this is part one, measuring. Mishnah 5. Niftaru zikne Yerushalayim v'halchu lahen. Then the judges from the Supreme Court in Jerusalem, they did their job. Their job was measuring. They leave. V'zikne ota ha'ir mivi'in eglat bakar asher lo ubad ba asher lo mashcha be'ol ve'in hamum posel ba. So then the local elders from whichever city is found to be closest bring this heifer that has never been worked. It's never been used to work the land. And unlike a normal sacrifice, if it has some kind of blemish that doesn't invalidate that, so this shows that this isn't to be treated as some sort of sacrifice, it's its own and kind of different ritual. Umoridino talanachal etan, and it is brought down to a hard wadi, right, that has a hard surface. Ve'etan kamashma'o kashe. What etan means is the literal meaning that it has to be hard, a hard surface of the ground. Afal pisha eno etan kasher. But if you don't happen to be able to find a hard wadi and with that kind of surface, it is still okay to do the ceremony, meaning this isn't me'akev, is the rabbinic language. It doesn't prevent you from doing the ritual. It's just ideally, this would be a hard surface where it seems to be some kind of symbolism of the lack of growth and fertility as some kind of symbolism for this person whose life was cut short. That's one interpretation. V'orfin ota b'kofitz me'achoreha, you break the neck with a hatchet from behind. We don't usually use a hatchet for shchita, so again, something that differentiates it from the usual process of shchita so that we not think that this is some kind of sacrifice happening outside the temple. Umekoma asur milizura umila avod umutar lisrok sham pishtan unaker sham avanim. You cannot use that land to sow seeds or to till the earth. Right, that is going to always be an area of land that is unfertile. But it is permitted to comb flax and chisel rocks, which are not things that involve growth from the land. Okay, Mishnah Vav. Ziknei ota ha'ir rochatzin et yedehen b'mayim bimkom arifa shel egla. So the elders of the city, they wash their hands with water in the place where they broke the neck of the calf, and they say the following thing that we saw in Hebrew. Yadeinu lo shafchu et hadam hazeh ve'ineinu lo ra'u. Our hands didn't spill this blood. Our eyes didn't see it, right? Didn't see the blood being spilled. And this is sort of one critical part of the Mishnah that relates to the question in the chat of, is this the extent of communal responsibility? Would we have even thought that the elders of the city were murderers, that they would have killed a person? Why do they have to say, we didn't spill this blood? Of course they didn't spill this blood. Of course our leadership would never be so low as to commit an act of murder, at least ideally. Ela shelo valiyadino uftarnuhu below mazon, below reinuhu v'hinachnuhu below levaya. What they're reclaiming responsibility for is, we didn't have him come into our hands and let him go without giving him food, right? They're saying we didn't fail to do our job in supplying somebody who was passing through our city food, and we didn't see him, we didn't witness this person leaving and not give him escort. That's what the elders of the city need to say to absolve themselves from responsibility. And this is where, actually they would need to think about whether that is true, right? Did they have the structures in place to make sure that anybody who went through the city would have any food they need if they are leaving, and that they would have proper escort and not be prone to attack. So that's where this formulation in the Mishnah leads to a kind of more expansive vision of what communal responsibility looks like. And I would say has kind of broad resonance for our moment in thinking through, well, what is the role of communal leadership to make sure to prevent an act of murder? V'hakohanim omrim, kaper la'amcha Yisrael asher padita Hashem v'al titein dam naki bekerav amcha Yisrael. So then the priests jump in and say this final piece, right, which is, right, to bring, right, God, bring atonement for your people Israel, who you've redeemed, and don't let this blood, the guilt of this blood of the innocent remain among your people. And the Mishnah adds here, lo hayu tzrichim lomar v'nikaper lahem hadam. They didn't really need to say this. They shall be absolved of blood guilt, meaning it's not the speech of the Kohanim, that speech act isn't what brings kapara. Ala ruach hakodesh mevasaratan. It's really God, right? God's spirit is announcing this, is relating this information. Imatai sheta'asu kacha, when you perform this ritual, hadam mitkaper lahem, then the blood will atone for you. So it's not the speech act of the Kohanim that brings kapara. They are just sort of reciting what God is informing the people that that this ritual will bring kapara. Okay. So yeah, I think this is one of the main sources for the idea of I wash my hands of this problem. Couldn't they have issued a death sentence? I'm not sure what that question means, but I think a later Mishnah might relate to that question. Meaning, how does this ritual relate to actually finding the murderer and justice for the murderer? And this is where I think, like, you might have read the Torah and assumed that this was some kind of sacrifice bringing atonement, and a lot of what the Mishnah is doing is pushing back against that, in laying out differences between this unusual sacrifice in terms of the animal can have a blemish, that it's not the normal way of doing shechita, ritual slaughter either. Okay, I know we're going through a lot here, but this is rich material and I want to make sure we see it all and get to the end of our masechet by the end of the week. So I'm gonna go on and do one more Mishnah here. What if the murderer is actually discovered before the heifer's neck is broken? So you maybe had that initial stage of the leaders coming from Jerusalem, measuring the closest city, but didn't get to the point of breaking the neck, and then they find the murderer. Then that heifer can go and be a normal heifer and graze in among the flock. Okay, then we don't do this ritual. If you find the murderer after the neck was broken, then this heifer is buried in that place, meaning you still can't get benefit from this heifer. That's one rule that relates to this heifer, is its body is forbidden in benefit. You can't use the hide for anything. So that would remain true even if the murderer is found. And this is where I want to highlight this language and how it relates to Sota. She'al safik, because this heifer was brought from the beginning in connection with a matter of doubt, right? There was real doubt for a certain period of time. It atoned for that doubt, which is now gone, right? I think very interesting here to say that even if there's some ultimate resolution later, there's a certain weight that this period of doubt has, uncertainty, fear that can come along with an unsolved murder for a period of time, that was real. And so this ritual served a purpose, even if ultimately the murderer is found. If the neck was broken and afterwards the murderer is found, the murderer needs to be executed, meaning the fact that this ritual happened to respond to the doubt and fear that existed is separate from the need to pursue justice. So it actually seems like it's not break the neck of the heifer, case closed. It's that this responds to a certain communal sense of doubt and fear and making sure that leadership is paying attention and being accountable, and still the justice system should pursue actually solving the case if that is possible and bringing the murderer to justice. Okay, we are gonna stop here for today, but I hope this felt like a particularly timely Mishnah to think through cases of murder, communal responsibility right here, case of doubt, but all the more so, right, the Mishnah is sort of pointing towards the proactive role leadership needs to have to ensure that this kind of thing does not happen. Okay, take good care, all.